our system that interfere with either you receiving the answer or us receiving the question. For urgent questions, we encourage you to call your local Rev because we are not an immediate answer service. But the response over the years has been extremely positive, and we've also been fortunate to run programs like this to help educate women in all areas of Taharas HaMishpacha, and we feel so lucky that we can help women keep this important mitzvah and be a resource for the community. Our speakers tonight really need no introduction, as they are well known in the community for their expertise and talents in their respective positions. Rabbi Yonah Reis is a noted Torah scholar, attorney, and jurist, and is the Av Beis Din of the Chicago Rabbinical Council and a Rosh Yeshiva at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary at Yeshiva University, where he serves as the Rabbi El Katz Chair in Professional Rabbinics. He's also a Chaver Beis Din of the Beis Din of America in New York, and he previously served as the Max and Marion Grill Dean of Reitz. Dr. Elman has been a board-certified OBGYN since 1995 and is a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Elman currently sees patients in Evanston and Glenview, and is, if you can schedule your appointments, a year out, and is affiliated with the hospitals of North Shore University Health System. She earned her medical degree at Washington University in St. Louis and completed her residency at the University of Chicago in 1999, where she was chief resident. She's been honored with multiple teaching awards from both residents and medical students. Dr. Plower is the board-certified OBGYN since 2008 and a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She's affiliated also with hospitals of North Shore University Health System. Dr. Plower graduated from the University of Illinois College of Medicine with honors and completed her OBGYN residency program at Northwestern University. I'm going to hand over the floor first to Dr. Plower and Dr. Elman to present the medical portion of the presentation, and then we're going to hear from Rabbi Reis about the halachic implications. Hopefully there's going to be time for questions at the end. We have some questions already submitted, but please feel free to write questions as the presentation goes, and we'll collect them. Without further ado, Dr. Elman and Dr. Plower.
Thank you very much for letting us come, and we picked a very broad topic, from birth to menopause. So I don't think we'll be covering all of that in 20 minutes, but this we were hoping would be kind of a starting place to give just some ideas for some of the decades that women go through. Please feel free to reach out to your OBGYN or to one of us if you have any questions about any of the specifics. We wrote a little bit of a mission statement. Just throughout the decades, women experience many changes in their own bodies. These can be both physical, such as an expanding to allow a baby to grow and thrive, to emotional as a result of hormonal changes. Our talk today is really just the tip of the iceberg of the changes that you can experience. We hope you have a strong and trusting relationship with your OBGYN and feel understood and supported to be able to discuss any questions or concerns that you might have. Dr. Plower is going to talk a little bit about some of the early years and the end years, and I'm going to talk about the middle. She is much more concise than I am, so I will try to keep it a little bit more.
If any of you have ever had an appointment with Dr. Elman, you know that to be true.
We'd still be there.
Or if you've ever waited for an appointment with Dr. Elman, you know that to be true. So with each of the little subsets, we listed some of the common things that we address in the OBGYN office, with the bold topic being the one that we're going to talk the most about as we're talking, but please feel free to ask us any questions about anything that's listed on the sheet or any other questions or concerns that you have. I would just like to start first with sort of the thing that brings many women first to the OBGYN office, and that is initially planning for pregnancy or preparing for childbirth. Our overall sort of philosophy about pregnancy and childbirth is that pregnancy is a really healthy, normal process for healthy women, and that one of the ways that you can make sure that you have a healthy pregnancy or that you can increase the chance that you're going to have a healthy pregnancy is to optimize your health prior to pregnancy. And this goes for whether it's your first pregnancy or subsequent pregnancies. And so thinking about sort of a list of things prior to pregnancy and really optimizing each of those things can help you have the healthiest pregnancy possible. Prior to the first pregnancy, I think it can be really helpful for a woman to have something called a preconception checkup to address any major questions that she has, but also to review the overall medical history to see if she has any medical problems like diabetes or any thyroid problems, to review with her any medications that she's taking to make sure that her list of medications is safe for use in pregnancy. And if it's not, to work with her and her other physicians to come up with ways to either stop taking those medications in a safe way or safer alternatives. To also review any vitamins or supplements that the woman is taking, because not all supplements are safe during pregnancy. It's also a good idea that visit to review a patient's family history. And if you've had pregnancies in the past, to also review your past pregnancies, what those outcomes were, if you had any complications. And if there were any instances in those pregnancies, what are things that we can do to be proactive in your next pregnancy to help reduce the chance that that thing is going to happen again? And like I said, this can be done for a first for a woman's first pregnancy prior to being pregnant, but subsequent to that, this is also something that you can address on a yearly basis if you're thinking about adding to your family in the coming year. As you go in to see your gynecologist for just your well woman visit, as you just go through the list of your health needs, you know, just check off the things of, you know, is there anything different that I should be thinking about if I'm thinking about, you know, pregnancy in the coming year. Other things to address as you're considering pregnancy, just your overall general lifestyle. We always want to promote a healthy diet for everybody, a nice, well-balanced, healthy diet, a healthy weight, because a healthy weight prior to pregnancy helps promote healthy weight gain during pregnancy. Being on a prenatal vitamin with enough folic acid prior to pregnancy helps reduce the risk of certain birth defects, as well as a good amount of healthy activity, physical activity and exercise. Generally speaking, we encourage women during pregnancy to help them continue the same types and amounts of physical activity during a pregnancy that they were doing prior to a pregnancy. And as pregnancy progresses, typically you have to modify that a little bit. But if you're nice and active prior to a pregnancy, please continue it during a pregnancy. And that's another thing that can help you have a good, healthy pregnancy. Another really important thing that you don't hear nearly as much about in the news now as you did a couple of years ago is to review your travel plans or travel history prior to pregnancy with respect to the Zika virus. Zika infection is still a problem in the Caribbean, in Central and South America, and in parts of Mexico and in certain parts of Asia. The entire United States, including Florida, is totally fine. So Florida's all good. But if you're planning on traveling elsewhere, it's a good idea to either check with your doctor or the CDC has a good website, just to check to make sure that you're not going to any areas that are affected by Zika. And really, I think addressing these areas either before your first pregnancy or between pregnancies allows you to have the healthiest pregnancy possible, and also the healthiest delivery possible and the best possible recovery from your delivery. Other things to always consider either before your first delivery or if you're moving to a new area or changing things, or if you've had to change your insurance, because we all know that that frequently changes, where do you want to deliver? What hospital? Where can you deliver? Do you want to see a doctor or a midwife? And as is always really important, can you communicate easily with your doctor or midwife? Because this is important not only on a day-to-day basis, at your routine appointments, when you have regular questions, but also if any problems arise during pregnancy at any point, to be able to make sure that any of your questions or concerns are addressed. All right. And now Dr. Ellen's going to talk for a long time.
I've got many pages, so. When I was thinking, so I was, we at first decided we were going to divide things up into decades, and we realized that really was not a good way to divide it up, and kind of divided things from leading up to getting ready, planning for pregnancy. And then I kind of got this chunk of time from the mid-20s all the way up to the mid-30s and 40s. And when I was thinking about how to break that down, because there's clearly a lot that's happening, is, you know, to me it seemed like we live our lives and we need to pay attention to being healthy individuals, healthy wives, and healthy mothers. And in each of those kind of categories, there are things that we need to pay attention to. When I was thinking about the mid-20s to 30s, as a healthy individual, we want to make sure we do all the right things. We want to make sure we eat well, we exercise, we want to pay attention to our mental well-being, we want to make sure we do periodic health monitoring, get cholesterol screening, all those kinds of basic things. And I think you could read about those anywhere and really talk to your general doctor about those things, as well as us, who often end up being your general doctor for these decades. As a wife, it's so important to try to have a good marital relationship. And, you know, many marriages face a lot of physical stress and emotional stress. And emotionally, you know, making sure that you and your partner are able to be on the same page through the easy times, but also the hard times. Family planning, dealing with older adults in the family who may need help, young children who may need help. There are a lot of stresses that relationships face, and trying to make sure that there's time spent to make sure you and your partner feel that you're going through this together and not at odds with each other is really important. Physically, the intimate relationship, you know, I think we feel so awfully when we have patients who we've seen for years who bring up that they're having troubles with their physical relationship with their partner. And we think we could have been so helpful 5 years ago, you know, earlier in the relationship. And it's important that part of your relationship as a wife is healthy too. And then clearly we spend a lot of time dealing with your health as a mother or between babies, you know, before, during, between, next time. Sometimes it's hard to believe I'm actually getting older because I don't feel like I am, but suddenly I see faces here and we've had many babies together. Intra-pregnancy health is really important. Clearly, the obstetric piece of what we do is important, but also taking care of women as they go from what we call the inter-pregnancy interval, from delivering one baby to conceiving the next baby. There's so much that happens in that time. Sometimes if that inter-pregnancy interval is short, it can impact the pregnancy. Sometimes if it's long, it can also impact the health of that pregnancy. And so kind of deciding as a couple, you know, with the guidance of your rabbi, what the right interpregnancy spacing is can be a really tricky question. You want to make sure that as you head into a pregnancy that your physical and emotional health is good. And for some women, that means not waiting very long. And for other women, it may mean waiting for longer. And our job is to be helpful with these issues. We do talk about the physical of getting back into shape, finding time, you know, to make sure between the breastfeeding and getting everybody out of the house that you get some time to exercise and eat well, that you pay attention to the importance of your own health. When we look at things like research studies that talk about the inter-pregnancy interval, none of them are very good. A lot of them talk about what the ideal amount of time is between one baby to the next. And sometimes I read these studies and wonder, what are your criteria for ideal? Because these certainly aren't, you know, kind of what we see happen in our real life sometimes. Ideally, according to these studies, the ideal interval is about 18 to 24 months between delivering one baby and conceiving the next. And hypothetically, in that time, the reason why that time is picked is they feel that most women are able to make sure that they have recovered from the birth of their child, had time to really optimize their health, and then been healthy enough to conceive another baby. And I think we all know in our own lives that for some of us women, that's more than enough time, and for others, maybe that's not enough. And again, those are the kind of decisions that need to come from how you're feeling about yourself and your own health, and how you're feeling as a family unit with your husband and with your rabbi. We do look at, you know, of course, we are lucky and most of our patients have healthy, normal pregnancies, labors, and deliveries. Sometimes we talk to women who've had a miscarriage, women who've had to deal with pregnancy complications like preeclampsia or high blood pressure, preterm deliveries. And sometimes when those things are present in a pregnancy, that interpregnancy interval needs to be a little bit different. One of the biggest things that we really push are for women who've had a C-section to consider this concept of VBAC, or vaginal birth after cesarean. And things can get a little tricky there. It's important to make sure that you've given, even though you may feel emotionally ready, you give your body enough time to heal so that you're optimally able to have a successful vaginal birth in a future pregnancy. Emotional health, I don't know if anyone in this room hasn't had the baby blues, and if so, I'm not sure I believe you. It is very common. Almost every woman gets it. The baby blues start usually 2 to 3 days after you deliver the baby, coincidentally right when you're going home with your baby, and then last usually for a couple of weeks. And I think we've all been there, emotional, crying, exhausted, just not feeling great, and then usually we kind of somehow get ourselves out of that. And that's very normal, and that's normal to happen to every single woman. We deal a lot with postpartum depression. A lot of emotional health issues get blamed on being postpartum, when not all of them are actually related to being postpartum, but a lot of them can be. Postpartum depression typically, so the postpartum period is usually the year after your baby's born. Most postpartum depression occurs, it starts either before you get pregnant or during your pregnancy. Over half start in those time periods, and really only a little bit less than half starts after you deliver your baby. So when Dr. Plower was talking about being preparing for pregnancy, your emotional health cannot be underemphasized. If you're starting off a pregnancy not in an emotionally good place, it's very likely you're going to end up not in an emotionally good place after you deliver the baby, plus then you have a lot more on your plate to handle and take care of. About 10% of women truly meet criteria for postpartum depression. And again, most of these women, if they're going to get postpartum depression, they're going to get it in the first 4 months after they deliver a baby. And again, maybe even starting before they deliver. So important things to pay attention to, and for us to kind of pay attention to, because we're seeing you in that time. And it's important to feel like you can bring these things up to your doctor. This topic is what I call the hand on the doorknob talk. Usually we've had a visit and I'm about to go out the room, and that's usually when a patient's finally able to say, wait, you know, I'm noticing this problem. And I would encourage everybody to bring it up even at the hand on the doorknob time, because it's important for us to make sure we're addressing these issues. In terms of a couple other things, just to move on to the next decade, the mid-30s to 40s, same thing again, being healthy as an individual, as a wife, as a mother, it's important to, again, make sure that we take care of ourselves in all of these arenas. And again, our job is to be helpful in all of these arenas. As an individual, one of the things that is constant about the menstrual cycle is it's going to change. Some for the better, some for the worse, some just a lateral move. But it's important to know that change is okay. And if there's ever something changing and you're not sure if it's okay, we want you to talk to us. Of course, the usual things, diet, exercise, physical health monitoring are important. This is also a really important decade, though, to take a second and think about things like family history. A lot of women have family histories of things like breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colon cancer. These can be especially relevant to women who are of Ashkenazi background. And, you know, as we hit the mid-30s to 40s, this is really the time when we might want to think about stepping up our surveillance to make sure we're not missing anything. If there is a family history, talk about genetic testing, those types of issues. So it's important to kind of know what your family history is so that we can help you know what we need to do about that. Gynecologically, this is not uncommon for us to see things like heavy periods, painful periods. Sometimes we have to talk to women who are having issues like bleeding between periods. These can all be huge medical concerns, but also lifestyle concerns and affect your relationship. We do talk about birth control, but we also use birth control not just as pregnancy prevention, but sometimes we also use it as treatments for abnormal bleeding issues. We use IUDs and birth control pills quite commonly to treat things like heavy periods, painful periods, not just for pregnancy prevention. And as a wife, sometimes as we travel through the 30s and 40s, things can change either after childbirth or just as time goes by, sometimes intimate relationships can get more difficult, and it's important to make sure that that doesn't, become such a big problem that affects your relationship. Our bodies change, our emotions change, as the kids get bigger, the problems get bigger. So sometimes, taking a little bit of time to stop as a wife to make sure your relationship is intact and, again, you feel like you're a partner going through these things together as much as possible. And then finally, as a mother, we all have known people who have pregnancies at all different stages of life, but as we get older, it can get a little bit harder. Risk for things like high blood pressure, diabetes can happen. Labors can get a little dysfunctional sometimes if we have more babies. Women who have cesarean births can be at increased risk for complications related to repeated cesarean births. So again, this intra-pregnancy discussion of making sure health is optimal and everybody's physically and emotional. So I do think that, as you go from the 20s to the mid-40s and everything in between there, which is a whole lot, it's always good to think about your health in these three separate kind of dimensions, because it's very easy to lose yourself as an individual amongst being a wife and a mother, or focus so much on your individual that it's hard to have an excellent wife relationship. And sometimes, I always wonder who's the one who gets the easy kids, because mine certainly aren't those. But, there's a lot going on in each of these compartments. And while we're a whole person, it's important that you pay attention to each one, not just for yourself, but also the example you're setting to the kids that your health is valuable. Your mental well-being is important. And then on to the end.
And then we come to the later 40s and into the 50s as we move on into perimenopause and menopause. So menopause, the average age for American women is 51, and that's defined as 12 full months without a period. So you can't actually say you're menopausal until it's 12 months after the fact. And perimenopause are the transition years leading up to that last period. And it's usually the 3 or 4 years leading up to that last period. And once again, just like in the 40s, change is the common thread here. The common symptoms with perimenopause, the main ones are a lot of menstrual cycle irregularity, especially with the timing of your menstrual cycle. Even if you were previously very, very predictable and very regular, you can start having a lot of longer cycles that are unpredictable in timing, as well as a lot of cycles that are just different from the other. So one cycle may be one way, and then you may go back to a normal pattern for a little bit, and then you may be doing something else totally different a couple of months down the road. All of this can come along with some intermittent periods where you don't get periods at all for 3 or 4 months, and then you go back to having periods again for a while. This is all interspersed with the other symptoms of menopause that you may have heard women talk about, things like hot flashes and night sweats. Those are some of the most common symptoms that women have. Those go along also with sleep disturbances, hormonal fluctuations, mood symptoms. Another really problematic one for women that they're frequently a little bit hesitant to talk about is vaginal dryness, and how that can affect their intimate relationship with their partner. And as all of these progress and eventually the periods stop, there are long-term effects of menopause. In addition to the fact that you just no longer have periods, the long-term lack of estrogen, which is what happens when you stop having periods, your ovaries aren't making the estrogen anymore. Over time, that leads to bone loss, so you're more likely to develop osteoporosis. So anything that you can do during your younger life to help develop and maintain nice, strong, and healthy bones, and to carry those healthy habits with you throughout life, are going to serve you well. So weight-bearing exercise, adequate calcium and vitamin D, those are all good to help develop and maintain good bone health. Decrease in estrogen is also linked to the increased risk in heart disease that women begin to have after menopause. And the vaginal dryness and the decrease in blood flow that happens with the decreased estrogen levels, as well as other changes in the vaginal tissue, can lead to changes in sexual function and your intimate relationship that for some women can end up causing pain, and sometimes it's a significant amount of pain. And if that is something that is problematic for you, I urge you to talk with your gynecologist, because there are so many things that can be helpful for relieving the pain that we are always very, very happy to talk about. But, you know, the OBGYN relationship is not something that is just there for obstetrics or just there for, you know, pap smears or birth control. It really is a relationship that should be there throughout your lifespan, and it's something that we as OBGYNs find extremely rewarding to take care of women throughout their lifespan. So from all the way in the early 20s all the way through all of the menopausal years, to be able to see that full range of women's health concerns.
Okay. Don't have anything additional to offer on the medical front, and it's a little bit intimidating for me. I'm so used to it, the best in being in the vast majority. Here, the tables have been turned. But I would like to speak about some of the halakhic issues, some of the rabbinic issues. Certainly, going into marriage in the first place, it's very strongly encouraged that a chassan and a kala, before their marriage, should speak about their expectations in terms of the number of children that they would like to have. Nobody has control over this. It's ultimately in the hands of Hashem. But still, that there shouldn't be a vast gulf between the expectations of one and that of the other, and that they should understand and have a commonality regarding the rabbinic authorities that they will turn to and the norms that will be followed in terms of vestos, in terms of abstaining during periods, in terms of the different halachos, the types of separations that will be observed between a husband and wife. Very often, people who are coming from the same type of cultural setting will have common expectations, but sometimes there are surprises, so it's best to minimize the surprises. And if these conversations haven't taken place during marriage, or a couple starts off and they realize that they're not entirely on the same page, then it's important to have these conversations as soon as possible in the beginning of marriage, and even if necessary, to sit down with the rabbinic authority that both parties are comfortable with and to ask for advice and guidance from the rabbinic authority. One thing that's good about competent rabbinic authorities anyway is that there's a tremendous emphasis on shalom bayis, on keeping the peace and happiness of the marital unit. So rabbis can often be very helpful at being able to put aside certain misconceptions, at being able to draw the two parties closer together, whether there are disagreements or differences that develop at the beginning of marriage or develop a few years into the marriage or develop much later on. After the couple has already had some children and they start to have disagreements about whether to just call it quits or whether to have more children and things of that sort, I have couples who come to me on a regular basis to discuss these issues, and I find that I'm able to be very helpful in terms of just reminding them that ultimately Jewish law also really places as paramount just the happiness of the couple above most other considerations, and therefore lots of things that you might not think are negotiable are ultimately negotiable. Not everybody names their children on their first date, but my wife reminds me that the first time that we went out, we decided on the name for our eldest son, and we decided on the name for our daughter. So we had to wait a little bit because we had five sons before we had a daughter, but once that was taken care of, so it was all decided on the first date. Not everybody necessarily has that mazel, so you have to work things out as you go along. The Gemara makes it clear that if there are serious tensions between a husband and wife, that's not going to be good for the welfare of the children. However, literally or allegorically, you understand the Gemara. It says if a couple is angry at each other and they have relations, so then there's some sort of a defect with the child. If the husband's thinking of divorcing his wife when he has relations, or he's thinking of another woman, so then that's going to have a deleterious effect on the children. What the Gemara is really saying is that the first and most important component of bringing children into the family is that there should be peace and harmony between the husband and wife. They should be on the same page. They should have a loving and caring relationship with each other. So one of the issues that comes across my rabbinic desk is with a newlywed couple asking whether it's appropriate to put off having children, whether it's ever called for, according to halacha, to postpone one's family until the couple can feel more at ease with each other, that they're able to establish more of an atmosphere of shalom bayis. So this is really very much a case-by-case determination. It's important for people, women in particular, not to feel embarrassed or uncomfortable to ask these questions of a Rav, because often the Rav can be very helpful in terms of navigating these types of questions and situations. The general rule is that the wife is the Akeres HaBayis. She's the one who is the pasuk we read in Hallel. We say Moshibi Akeres HaBayis Eim Avanim Smecha Haluka. So the literal translation is usually that God helps out that a woman who's barren, that she can be an Eim Avanim, that she can have children and be happy by having a family of children. But many of the commentaries translate Akeres HaBayis as Ikar HaBayis. She's the mainstay. She is the base and the cornerstone of the house, and everything revolves around her. And if you look even at the stories of the Avos and the Imos, the interactions between Avram and Sarah, between Yitzchak and Rivka, between Yaakov and his wives. So the wives were the ones who were calling the shots about, okay, now it's time to daven for children. Now I really want a child or else my life is ruined. It was the wife who usually decided when it was time to have children and how important it was for her to have children. And this is something from a rabbinic perspective that we also look at as well. What is the emotional state? What is the physical state? What is the readiness of the wife in terms of having children? One of the questions that's posed by the commentators is, why is it that a man has a mitzvah of procreating, of pru or vu, and a woman does not have the same mitzvah? There's some question, maybe a woman has a mitzvah that she should bring at least one child into the world. Lo sol avara, lo sheres yitzara, that the world was created to be populated, so therefore a woman is supposed to fulfill perhaps the mitzvah shevis, which means she should have at least one child, but a man is obligated to have at least one boy and one girl, according to the strict halacha. So why is it that a woman doesn't have a similar obligation? And if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, it doesn't look like a woman even has necessarily an obligation of shevis either to bring any children into the world. So some say a woman doesn't need an obligation because every woman has such an innate and strong desire to have children, you don't have to impose an obligation upon her. But the Meshech Chochmah, Bermeya Simcha of Divinsk, explains that the reason there's no obligation imposed upon a woman is because she's the one who has to go through all of the work. That it's not fun and games necessarily to become pregnant and to bear a child. So because it can be very taxing, and because it can even come with a certain amount of danger, the Torah is not going to impose upon a woman that she has to endure and suffer that degree of danger, and therefore it's not imposed upon her as an obligation. So if you look at it in that sense, the woman really has to feel that she's ready to have children. Most women do feel a desire, and most women do feel a compelling a need to bring a child into the family. But if for whatever reason a woman's going through an emotional state where it's difficult for her, so this is definitely something that has halakhic significance in terms of allowing a couple to put off having children. My own general advice to a couple, certainly when it's the wife who wants to have children and the husband wants to put it off, I have no sympathy for him whatsoever. Number one, he has an obligation. Number two, he married the woman. This is what he got himself into. She wants a child. He should have a child. But even if both parties are reluctant, I do encourage that couples should, unless there is some very serious danger or some serious genetic disorder that's been discovered, or you know, something else along those lines, I do encourage a couple to try to have a child as soon as possible, simply because the biological reality is that often we see couples who struggle to have children. And then they have to engage in assisted reproductive technologies in order to, in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination, and all kinds of different techniques to bring a child into the world. It could be extremely difficult. That's much more emotionally taxing than an initial reluctance to take on the burdens of parenthood. And when a couple is very young, it's much easier. Just statistically, it doesn't always work out, but it's much easier statistically to have a child. I've seen cases, I knew of one case where a couple wasn't so observant before they got married. They were living together. They became Baalei Tshuva. While they were living together, the girl became pregnant, and she ended up having an abortion. She didn't want to have a child out of wedlock. They got married, and she wasn't able to conceive. She wasn't able to conceive anymore. So what comes easy at the beginning doesn't necessarily become easy or remain easy as time goes on. So I think it's a good idea. The parties don't generally regret it. I had a couple in my office a couple of years ago. They were getting married, and the husband really wanted to put off having a child the worst way until he took his law boards. So he said, let's at least stop, put off getting pregnant for a couple of months. And I saw that this was going to be a serious shalom bias issue at the beginning of marriage. I said, I'll give you 2 months, but not another day. And then they had a child about 9 months after that. And now they had another child, and they don't even remember anymore the initial reluctance about having children right away. And Baruch Hashem, it's always a good thing to be able to have children as soon as possible. But then the question becomes, what's the right amount of spacing, or is there an appropriate amount of spacing between children altogether? The Chazon Ish wrote that so a woman reasonably needs about 6 months, he writes, to relax between pregnancies. So even if a couple doesn't have many children, that certainly seems to be an appropriate measure of time. Others say what I think Dr. Elman and Dr. Plower mentioned before, that 18 to 24 months is sometimes an appropriate measure of time. And where the rabbis got that from is from the various Gemaras, the various Talmudic passages that indicate that a woman doesn't generally, at least in the days of the Gemara, a woman wouldn't generally get pregnant while she was nursing, and that a woman's nursing period was generally expected to continue for a 2-year period of time. So they would say there was a minhag, there was a custom. Not all of the rabbis were in favor of this custom, but there was a custom for many women to wait 2 years before pregnancies, meaning after a child would be born, they would wait 2 years before they would try to become pregnant again. And then there are even some authorities that say that since the Talmud speaks about how certain children needed to be nursed for more than 2 years, they needed to be nursed for up to 4 years, that one could, on certain occasions, even space up until 4 years
So I think the general rabbinic orientation is, as I said, case by case. You look at the couple, you look at what they can handle, you look at the challenges that face them, you look particularly at what the wife is able to handle. But in particular, once a couple has already fulfilled the mandate of pru avu, of having children, at least one child, which is a fulfillment of Shevis, and certainly if there's been at least one boy and one girl. With us, we couldn't space so much because it took us six children. So we had a girl. But once you have at least one boy and one girl, so then there is a lot more flexibility in terms of the spacing. Now, how do you space? That itself is a rabbinic discussion. It's important for a couple to consult with rabbinic authorities about what are considered to be acceptable forms of birth control. Some types of birth control are much more halakhically acceptable than others, and really no form of birth control is acceptable unless there's a heter, unless there is some sort of a determination that some type of spacing is appropriate, and you have to consult with your rabbinic authorities about how much spacing is going to be appropriate for you. So the best type of birth control is usually taking a pill, what we call the pill birth control, because it doesn't interfere with the act of intercourse at all. But it creates hormonal issues and sometimes staining and spotting, and therefore that's not always ideal. And there's a whole discussion in the Talmud about what they had as an early form of a diaphragm that was known as a moch. Really was cotton, that when the husband would have intercourse with the wife, so he would be going straight on to this cotton instead of into the wife's body. So it was considered problematic because really the act of intercourse is supposed to allow the husband's seed to enter into the vaginal canal and into the wife's body. So that was only, there was a discussion in the Talmud about whether that's only allowed for certain women or whether that's where it would be a danger for them to become pregnant if they were very young or already pregnant. They wouldn't become pregnant, but maybe it wouldn't be good for them, or they were nursing. Or whether maybe the dispute in the Talmud was not whether it's permissible or not, but rather whether it's obligatory or not in those cases, but really it would be permissible for everybody. So this is where the rabbis have a lot of fun discussing all of the different opinions and the different interpretations of the Talmud. But then the part that's much more serious is figuring out how to apply that halacha l'maisa, how to apply that in terms of practical halacha. And there's also a distinction between this moch contraption that was mentioned in the Gemara and more modern-day devices that are more recessed into the woman's body, where it doesn't necessarily interfere with the regular act of intercourse between the husband and wife, where the man's seed is able to enter into the vaginal canal much more smoothly and naturally. So when you have something like an IUD that just serves as sort of a barrier further in, that's much less problematic. So the big issue with the IUDs that the rabbis talk about are, number one, they generally are inserted for a longer period of time, and that therefore could delay a woman's next pregnancy much longer, and you have to figure out when that's appropriate and when that's not appropriate. And secondly, one of the issues the rabbis have spoken about more recently is that now they have these contraptions that are so good, they prevent the women from having periods altogether. So a number of rabbanim mentioned to me that once a woman gets past her early years of marriage, where she wants to become pregnant and therefore she's having regular periods, at least until each pregnancy seeps in, they're not getting questions anymore. They're not getting shyless from women about when to count their periods and things of that sort, because they're just not having periods altogether. So here, too, it requires some type of rabbinic consultation, because there are some rabbinic authorities who will say that if you even have a tiny little amount of spotting, it might even be a show up on a colored garment, but that's all that happens. But that's your regular new period. that's occurring on a monthly or a bi-monthly basis. So some rabbis will consider that to be a period. They'll consider that to be ample grounds for a husband to separate from his wife. Not all rabbis agree with that approach, but you can't assume that whatever rules apply before you put in your birth control contraptions are going to apply afterwards, and therefore you have to consult with rabbis at every point along the way. In terms of menopause and perimenopause, here as well, what happens halakhically, let's say, even if you don't have an IUD, what happens is that women notice that the periods start spreading out a lot more. That also has halakhic implications, because generally speaking, if a woman doesn't have, we assume that most women nowadays don't have regular periods like clockwork. Every now and then I come across a woman who has a regular period like clockwork, and she's very proud of it, you know, and because she's very much the exception to the rule, so okay. But most women, it could be 28 days one month, 31 days the next month, and 29 days. There's no real set pattern. What we call a vesis she'eno kavua. So a woman has to abstain from her husband every single month in what we call the ona beinonis. So whatever is sort of 30 days after her previous period. Some say 31 days, some say the same day of the month. There are different, to whatever interval separated between the previous two sightings, you have to separate whenever you reach that interval. I'm not going to go through all of the laws. You've all covered them with your kala teachers when you got married, and you occasionally, I'm sure, have refresher courses, and now they have computer programs. But one thing that could change is that, yes, according to certain rabbinic authorities, once the period sightings become more spread out, so that, for example, you never have a period that occurs less than 30 days or 31 days prior to your previous period. So always say 33 days or 34 days or more, and that starts to happen as you approach menopause. So according to certain rabbinic authorities, you don't have to abstain anymore during what we call the ona beinonis, that 30-day period, the 31-day period, or the same day of the month period. You'd only have to abstain for the interval between the previous two sightings. If it was 43 days, so you abstain on the 43rd day after your next sighting. So there are all kinds of leniencies that might be applicable to you, which is why when you do have these types of changes, it's important to consult with rabbinic authorities. I always say one of the most important reason to consult with the rabbinic authorities is to discover all the leniencies. Because what happens is that when people don't ask questions, they tend to just be machmir, they tend to just be overly stringent for themselves. Even when it comes to looking at maros, looking at the shades of color that might have appeared on a pad when you were checking yourself during your clean days. So women who decide that they don't want to show it to a rabbi tend to be more stringent than is necessary when it comes to these matters. And that also can hold up having a child, because if a woman abstains from her husband more than she needs to, she might miss, you know, a golden opportunity to be with her husband during a day that she would be close to ovulation, when she would really be able to get pregnant. And these are all important reasons why you have to always consult with your local rabbinic authority. The last thing that I'll say is that the mitzvah that applies throughout marriage, that primarily devolves upon the husband. So I don't have to mention it so much to you, but just so that you should hold your husbands to, you know, this standard. But the main mitzvah that the husband has is v'simachas ishto asher lakach, that he's supposed to make his wife happy. It doesn't say v'simach im ishto asher lakach, as Rashi points out. It doesn't say he's happy with his wife. He has to make his wife happy, because if the husband doesn't make his wife happy, then he's not going to be happy, and it's not going to be a happy home. You have the right to demand happiness. If there's anything in the course of the marriage where you feel that you're being put upon, where you feel that you're being pushed to a pregnancy that you don't want, or you're being pushed not to be pregnant when you want to have another child, and it's taking away from your happiness, so you have the right to turn to your husband and say, hey, your job is to make me happy. If we're going to build a home that's not premised upon my happiness, that's not a proper Jewish home. A successful and flourishing Jewish home is a Jewish home which is premised upon the wife's happiness. So I want you to remember that at all times.
I'm going to walk around now. If anyone has a card or a question, I'll collect it.
I have a few
ready to start.
Let's start
with a few that we have before.
Okay, so a little bit more, bringing it down practically to some of the questions that come up across the hotline that we've gotten from people who submitted questions. But in terms of if somebody is going to be on birth control, first of all, are there better options in terms of what would cause the least amount of staining? And also getting into the IUD situation, could you discuss from halachic standpoint and from medical standpoint in terms of preferred timing of insertion of the IUD, how to deal with staining once you're on the IUD, if there's anything else you could take on top of the IUD to help with staining? I'll start off with that question. It's a big one.
To break that down really quickly, we do quite commonly use either birth control pills or IUDs for women that are in between babies and want birth control. And the timing is really one of the crucial things. So first of all, for a woman who's breastfeeding, the regular birth control pill, which contains estrogen in it, is not preferred method of birth control because it will lower the milk production. So usually women who are postpartum are offered either a special pill called the mini pill, which only contains a little bit of progesterone in it every single day, no placebos, or an IUD. And the IUDs come in two varieties. They come in a hormonal IUD variety, which has two sizes, but the most common one for a woman who's between babies is something called the Mirena, which is an IUD that secretes a little bit of progesterone into the uterus, and it's good for up to 5 years for birth control, but can come out at any time. Or a non-hormonal IUD, or the copper IUD, it's also known, Paragard is the official name of it, which sits in the uterus. It doesn't secrete any hormone at all, so a woman will have no extra hormone in her body with that. But the reason why a woman might pick a hormonal IUD over a non-hormonal IUD is most women with the hormonal IUD either have very minimal to no periods. And for some women, there are some women who just prefer not to have a period. There are other women who have periods that can be pretty heavy or painful. So for some women, they prefer to have the IUD that would prevent them from getting a period. And then to just launch into that a little bit farther, so after a woman's had a baby, it is very common, as everyone knows, to have some bleeding for weeks after you have had the baby. And it can quickly go down to a small drip, 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 but that drip, drip, drip can last for quite some time, 5 to 6 weeks, sometimes even maybe a little longer. And so it's not uncommon that we'll see a woman at 6 weeks postpartum, and it's also not uncommon for a busy woman to say, hey, can you just put in my IUD while I'm here so I don't have to come back? And the problem is, if that woman hasn't yet been to the mikvah for the first time and we put the IUD in, it is normal to see possibly a little bit of staining even for a few months after that IUD goes in, which would delay a woman's ability to get the mikvah for quite a long time, possibly. So usually we will recommend to a woman that she, of course, have the discussion with her husband, do we want an IUD, and maybe have a discussion with her rabbi about, you know, at what point, if I were to wait, get to the mikvah, and then have my IUD placed, do I need to then be continuing to look and to check to see if I'm having any bleeding? And most women are allowed to not have to take that extended time period to keep looking and checking. You know, it's funny, in our country, we do things certain ways, and in other countries, people do things differently. And I had one of my patients who got her IUD put in Israel say, well, my doctor in Israel just gave me some extra progesterone after my IUD went in, and my bleeding got better a lot faster. And I, you know, my first response was, well, that's not what we do. And then I thought about, well, why don't we do that? Well, I think just because nobody ever thought to do that. So sometimes, you know, I'll talk to a patient and say, you know, give it a little bit and just let the IUD settle in. But sometimes we can give a little extra progesterone or progesterone pill on top of the IUD to kind of help that little bit of spotting that can happen with it go away a little bit faster. But traditionally we don't, but there's really absolutely no reason why we couldn't. If we had to.
Okay.
Yeah. Whenever we have a concern that the placement of the IUD itself is going to cause some spotting or staining, so we recommend that it should be placed during a time when the woman is off limits to her husband anyway, so that way it's not going to create a new requirement for the two spouses to separate from each other. But what does end up being a common question
is precisely this situation where a woman has just given birth, and her doctors are telling her that if she is going to put in an IUD, it would be a very bad idea to put it in too soon, and she has to wait a period of time. And yet, she reaches the point in which she stops seeing blood, and she's ready to go to the mikvah. I mean, technically speaking, after a woman has a boy, she could go to the mikvah after 7 days if she doesn't see any more blood. It doesn't happen. And after a girl, she'd go to the mikvah after 14 days if she goes 7 days without seeing any blood during that 14-day period. So it sometimes happens that 20 days or so after giving birth, the woman's ready to go to the mikvah. It does happen, and yet the doctors say it's not a good idea to put in the IUD, and she's not ready to get pregnant again, and it's not a good idea for her to get pregnant again. And then the question is, should she go to the mikvah altogether, given that if the husband's going to be with her, maybe she'll get pregnant if she doesn't have any kind of protection. And in some communities, they have just a bright line rule that a woman doesn't go to the mikvah altogether for 6 weeks, for 8 weeks, just to be able to recover. I don't think that's the general practice in our community. I think in our community, the woman generally goes to the mikvah as soon as she's able to go to the mikvah. And sometimes if you advise the husband, try not to have relations with your wife, it doesn't always work out that way. So what I will do is say there are other types of birth control that aren't quite as surefire. The woman probably won't want to take pills either for the same reason during that period of time. She could use foam, use a spermicide during that period of time. It's not as 100% effective or reliable as an IUD, 90% effective. So I say that if you are willing to take a chance and you don't want to abstain from having marital relations for a longer period of time, some people are willing. Sometimes the woman is more than happy to take a break. She needs a break emotionally and physically anyway. But sometimes if they really want to be with each other, so I'll tell them that they can use that. Halakhically speaking, it's also not considered to be direct wasting of seed, because the act of intercourse is a regular act of intercourse. It's not necessarily something that we would always recommend for the long term, but for the short term, that's often how we handle that situation. I've never had a mishap from that recommendation, but these are challenging times when you have to deal with that type of question.
Does prolonged use of birth control pills affect menopause?
No.
They really shouldn't. It can make it hard to, sometimes the birth control pill just being hormone could make it hard for a woman to see some of the signs that menopause is coming. So hot flashes, irregular cycles, yeah. You could miss that, but it doesn't inherently change anything about the timing.
Yeah.
Okay. If a woman's on a 3-month kind of pill, or this is more for Rabbi Reese, I guess, halachically, but if a woman's on either a 3-month kind of pill or she's on a regular pill where she double packs or triple packs on her pills, how would that affect her keeping her calendar days in terms of keeping the 30-day interval or any of the other intervals?
The generally accepted opinion is that if she's on a pill which regulates her cycle so that she's always going to have a period, say, 2 days after she goes off, or it's going to be a 28-day cycle, it'll be a 56-day cycle, whatever it's going to be, so then she can discount her previous periods and just base herself on whatever is going to be the regular cycle that's brought about by the birth control pill. But as soon as she goes off the pill, then she goes back to her previous cycles, whatever they were, or the regular regime of unpredictable cycles of the Onah Beinonis and the Onah Sachodesh and the Onah Saploga and all of the other regular times that she would have to separate. But during the time she's on the pill, so then it's a different regime.
Okay, this is more for the doctors. If you don't prepare before pregnancy, can you still exercise slowly and increase exercise during pregnancy?
Yes. Yes, and I would say my general recommendations for exercise during pregnancy are there are a few things you shouldn't do, so no extreme sports, nothing that has a high risk of abdominal trauma, nothing that's going to involve flipping through the air. But those all seem like things to avoid during pregnancy. But generally speaking, moving your body during pregnancy should feel good while you're doing it. It shouldn't cause any pain, and you should feel good afterwards. You should exercise to the point that you're out of breath, but that you can still talk to a person if they were on a treadmill next to you. And if you're ever exercising so intensely that you can't talk, then that's a little bit too intense for pregnancy. And if you're ever exercising so intensely that you're having cramping, that's too intensely for pregnancy. And you should back off if it's that intense, or if you're having pain, find a modification for that activity.
Okay. In both of everyone's experience here, are there any common issues where the medical side and the rabbinic side kind of butt heads a little bit and experience misunderstanding, and how can we best fix that misunderstanding and kind of
I do think that on the medical side, I'll own it and say that sometimes there can be definitely a lack of understanding on our end of what sometimes our patients are facing in terms of some of the challenges that relate to either timing of things or, you know, a good example will be induction of labor. I think everybody reaches a point in pregnancy at which they just want to be done. And yet there's a difference between how you're feeling and what really is the right thing to do. And, you know, I would say that, yes, these issues do come up. And I think as a practice, we've been educating ourselves on understanding these laws. If someone calls on a Friday at 3 o'clock and they're having spotting, why is that important Friday at 3 o'clock? And it is important. And I think it, in our sense, in our office, it took some education to really realize what these issues really mean to the patient. You know, I could say to someone, you're spotting, that is not a life-threatening issue, but it can be a really big issue for a woman. I think that, you know, from our end, a lot of it is making sure we understand what's really the question that a patient's asking. Because I do think that sometimes we could be at odds with what the patient really needs. And it's important for the patient that we are on the same page for that woman to get the best care she can.
Right. Even when it comes to, you know, different types of birth control, you know, the types that are recommended by Dr. Ellman and Dr. Plower, for example, are consistent with the types that would be, you know, recommended by rabbinic authorities. But, you know, even then, would only be recommended if we felt that it was, you know, warranted under the circumstances. But, you know, so there are other types that are simply, you know, unacceptable almost 100% of the time, according to Jewish law, like, you know, the use of a condom, for example. That would be a complete wasting of seed that we would, you know, pretty much never allow. You know, maybe if somebody's life was otherwise in danger, like a case where somebody had the Zika virus, you know, something like that, then it would be at least a discussion. But most of the time it would be, you know, a non-starter. So, you know, with things like that, it's important for, you know, the medical professionals who are advising the women in the community to know about the fact that there are limitations, that there may need to be a consultation, even when it comes to a pregnancy where there's a major defect and they might, or a fear of a major defect, like that the child is suffering from some very, you know, serious genetic disorder, and they would advise the woman to go for amniocentesis, and often the rabbinic authorities would say, we're not going to permit an abortion anyway, either under these circumstances or at this stage of the pregnancy or based on the combination of these circumstances in the stage of the pregnancy. And therefore, given that amniocentesis can actually harm the fetus, it would be forbidden under these circumstances to do amniocentesis. So these are areas where, you know, these sometimes come to friction between the two different sources of authority. Or even when a woman's thinking that, okay, she's had enough children, she's fulfilled pour vous, you know, in grandiose fashion, she has 15 children already, and rather than IUD, she wants to tie her tubes, which would be a problem halakhically of sirus, of sterilization, which is forbidden, you know, for women, at least rabbinically, if not on a Torah level. It's a dispute between different authorities, but it's certainly prohibited on some level. And there, too, the medical professionals might not necessarily appreciate just how drastic a step this is from a halakhic perspective. And yet, at the same time, it could be warranted in certain extreme cases. But this is why it's important just to be aware of these sensitive areas so that, you know, there'll be knowledge of when the advice that's being doled out will have to, you know, be discussed with the rabbinic authorities, and you know, the rabbinic authorities might even need to have a conversation with the medical professionals to understand the exigencies of this particular situation so that they can, you know, make a more informed halakhic decision.
Is there an age at which it would be okay to say, we're done, we can't really have more children, or we're not comfortable having more children, and met from the medical perspective, is there an age that you would, I mean, it's probably dependent on each person individually, but is there an age or a range of an age where you would say it is more kind of dangerous to go there, and from a halakhic perspective, is it okay to get to a point where you say, we are done?
I think it's okay halakhically to get to the point where you could say that we're done. And I think that it's primarily, you know, the woman that needs to make that decision of when she feels that she's done. It's a more of a question if the couple doesn't have any children yet, if they only have, you know, one child. So, you know, then it needs to be more of a rabbinic guided discussion. You know, it's always good to consult with the rabbis anyway, but, you know, especially if a woman has gone through a lot of trauma, she's had difficult pregnancies. I know with my own wife, she had a pregnancy with, she had gestational diabetes, and then she had a miscarriage, and we were wondering, you know, at what point should we call it quits? I'm not saying we've called it quits, but, you know, at a certain point we went to... Even the rabbis, they have to have rabbinic advisors, and our rabbinic advisor said six is a nice number. So, there comes a point for everybody.
Would you have an opinion about that, or it's specific?
I do think it is really case-by-case specific. It's really rare that we would ever tell a woman, we think you should be done, based on something that's happening medically. But you know, the risk for things like diabetes, hypertension, all these things really start to increase as women get older. And I find that most of my patients know when they're ready without, you know, mostly need their affirmation or, you know, a second opinion, but yeah.
Can the doctor speak a little bit more to the women who are experiencing infertility?
It's hard. It's so hard. It's heartbreaking. It's frustrating. And it's something that I think a lot of women struggle with quietly, and that they don't talk about. And that there are so many things that we... as gynecologists, just like from an entry level, aid with gynecology can be helpful for, both from just like an assessing of the menstrual function, and as well as doing some initial testing. Many, many times we go through all of this testing, and ultimately the answer is that there's not really a good explanation as to why a given couple can't conceive, but that that many times with, you know, persistence and assistance, those couples are able to have children, but that it is something that it can cause a great deal of emotional distress, both for a woman, but also for a couple, and that we have a great deal of compassion for.
Thank you. Okay, we don't want to hold anybody hostage for too long tonight, but thank you, everybody, for coming. I think you have agreed to stay a little bit, and people have questions that they want to come up to ask, and we hope to see you at our future events.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming.